Asian problem, Zhu Enlai immediately went to work behind the scenes to bring the belligerents together to reach an acceptable political solution. He started by getting the French and the DRV delegates to sit down in private on the 17th of May and discuss the issue of recovering wounded soldiers at Dien Bien Phu. On that same day, Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov proposed the debut of negotiations on the armistice. In a concession designed to advance negotiations, Zhou Enlai announced on the 20th of May that the situation in Laos and Cambodia was different from that of Vietnam. In short, the Chinese premier no longer supported the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's right to speak for Western Indochina. Not only did this respond to Western demands to reject the counter-associated states created by the DRV in 1950, but it was also part of Zhao's plan to neutralize non-communist Asia in relation to the Americans, including Laos and Cambodia, if proved to be necessary. More than anyone else, Zhou Enlai rolled back Vietnamese internationalist claims to Western Indochina in order to show his wary Indian, Burmese, and Indonesian counterparts that the communists were no longer serious about exporting communism beyond Vietnam's borders in post-colonial Asia. The Vietnamese agreed and, in so doing, let go of their Indochinese ambitions, at least for the time being. The second concession was about where to provisionally partition Vietnam. On the 10th of June, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam delegation informed the French that they would be open to the idea of dividing Vietnam until general elections could be held to unify the country. However, negotiations hardly advanced beyond that. There was little agreement as to where, exactly, the line dividing Vietnam should go. And when the conference's discussions on Korea broke down in mid-June, things looked equally bleak for Indochina, where an armistice had not even been reached. To head off a diplomatic failure, on the 16th of June 1954, Zhou Enlai informed the British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, that he would be able to get Pham Van Dong to agree to pull DRV troops out of Laos and Cambodia. This coincided with the fall of the French government on the 13th of June and its replacement by one headed by Pierre Mendès France, who was determined, like Zhou Enlai, to reach a negotiated settlement at all costs. Not only did Mendès France up the ante by announcing that he would personally negotiate at Geneva and resign in 1 month's time if an agreement were not reached, but he also threatened to institute a national draft and bring in the U.S. in order to put added pressure on his communist counterparts to make a deal. Bluff or not, this seriously alarmed the Chinese, the Soviets, and the DRV. Outstanding issues included determining the line of partition for Vietnam and setting a date for general elections within the country. As for the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, its leadership was opposed to accepting the 17th parallel as the demarcation line, since it would mean surrendering vast territories in central Vietnam the DRV had ruled since 1945. On the 23rd of June 1954, Zhou Enlai informed Mendès France that the questions of elections and partition would have to be negotiated one way or another to reach an agreement. He then left the conference to consult his government, regional neighbors, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam leadership. In Asia, Zhou Enlai stopped over in New Delhi, where he reassured Nehru of Communist China's peaceful intentions, which would be demonstrated in exchange for the implicit neutrality of non-communist Asia. Zhou Enlai informed Nehru that the kingdoms of Laos and Cambodia would be neutral, part of what he and Nehru called Southeast nations of a new type, that is, non-communist and non-aligned post-colonial Asian states. On the 29th of June 1954, Zhou Enlai signed the Five Principles of Peaceful Coexistence with his Indian and Burmese counterparts. Zhou then made his way to the southern Chinese city of Liuzhou, where he held a crucial meeting with Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap on the final negotiating strategy to be adopted at Geneva. Between the 3rd and 5th of July 1954, Zhao Enlai argued that direct American intervention was possible, even likely, in the event the Geneva Conference talks failed. Such a scenario, he stressed, would greatly complicate the DRV's war, not to mention China's own security. He explained that neutral countries such as India and Burma were hostile to American intervention in the region, but needed to be reassured that Sino-Vietnamese internationalism remained limited to Vietnam. This meant that the Vietnamese had to let go of their Indochinese ambitions. It was eventually agreed that the 16th parallel could serve as the temporary dividing line for Vietnam. A non-communist political solution was to be accepted for Cambodia, and that the Chinese and Vietnamese would negotiate strongly in order to acquire regrouping zones for the Pathet Lao in Upper Laos. These areas would be the provisional home to Pathet Lao troops and administrators until elections were held to create a new government for all of Laos. Ho concurred, and both sides agreed to coordinate their policies so as to reach an agreement with Mendes France. Upon his return, Ho argued successfully to his party that these concessions, including the division of Vietnam at the 16th parallel, were vital to obtaining an accord and preventing the Americans from intervening directly. Back in Geneva, Zhao, Eden, Molotov, and Mendes France accelerated their efforts to reach an agreement before the Frenchman's deadline arrived. With the clock ticking, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam finally agreed to pull its troops out of Laos and Cambodia and accepted the partition of Vietnam at the 17th parallel, falling just south of the city of Vinh, a serious further concession of territory. DRV troops and personnel in Cambodia, Laos, and southern Vietnam would be regrouped to northern Vietnam, whereas those of the Associated State of Vietnam and French Union forces would regroup to the south. Son Ngoc Minh's Cambodian forces laid down their arms and were reintegrated into the royalist forces or returned to civilian life. In Laos, regrouping zones were created for the Pathet Lao in the Lao provinces bordering northern Vietnam, Phang Sa Li, and Sam Nuea. The Geneva Conference created an international commission for supervision and control for Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Elections were scheduled to be held in mid-1956 in all of Vietnam in order to decide under which Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam or the State of Vietnam, the country would be unified. In the early hours of the 21st of July, 1954, the French and the DRV initialed a ceasefire. The first Indochina war had officially come to an end. Vietnamese communists agreed with the Sino-Soviet decision to shift to détente and open negotiations on Indochina. They also shared the Chinese fear that if an agreement were not reached at Geneva, then it was likely that the Americans would intervene directly. This they did not want. In February 1954, as talks were underway in Berlin, and again on the eve of the opening discussion of Indochina at Geneva, the Vietnamese communists affirmed their commitment to adopting a negotiating strategy to end the war, and which would contribute to bringing peace to Asia and the world, in collaboration with the Soviets and Chinese. During the negotiations at Geneva between May and July, the Soviets and Chinese did indeed push the Vietnamese to back off from the international communist model of Indochina and accept the neutrality and reality of royalist governments there. The Chinese put pressure on their counterparts to accept the 17th parallel in order to cut the final deal at Geneva. But Vietnamese party documents also show that their Politburo had agreed that it could not continue the war. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu was a glorious victory, but the war, especially the shift to conventional warfare and simultaneous social revolution, had exhausted the people and the army. During the party's sixth plenum, held between the 15th and 17th of July, 1954, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's leaders justified the decision to sign the Geneva Accords by shifting from an armed line to one of negotiations. drawing upon arguments he had developed with Zhao Enlai a week earlier at Liuzhou, Ho explained that the main enemy in Indochina was no longer the French, but the Americans, who were now bent on war at both the global and Indochinese levels. Ho argued that while the victory at Dien Bien Phu demonstrated the increasing strength of the DRV's armed forces, it had also served to draw the attention of the Americans to Vietnam. This had increased Washington's resolve to take a more direct stand against the communists in Indochina and to broker a deal in Geneva in order to prevent the DRV from taking all of Vietnam, either diplomatically or military. Ho insisted that the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had to exploit the contradictions in the international system, especially the reluctance of the British and French to follow the Americans in order to reach an international agreement that could isolate the USA. If the DRV could achieve unification via elections and negotiations, then all the better. He added that while the Vietnamese had become stronger compared to the French, they did not yet have the decisive Cong Phai Tuy Toi threshold needed to impose a crushing victory in all of Vietnam. 2 days later, the Communist General Secretary Truong Chinh conceded that the DRV's armed forces had become stronger and that increased force had culminated in the Dien Bien Phu victory, but that the change in armed force was not yet a fundamental one. Ngang Chua Thay Doi Ve Can Ban. The armed forces had won a battle, but they were not necessarily in a position to win the war decisively throughout the country. He also pointed out that there was a war faction in French ruling circles, one which was intent on carrying out the war to the end. These leaders were quite ready to use the Geneva Conference as a way of internationalizing the war to isolate the Democratic Republic of Vietnam along Cold War lines. They were also ready to turn to the Americans to help them finish off a war they themselves could not win. This, the General Secretary warned, was a reality the leadership simply could not ignore. As Truong Chinh put it, the Americans had already replaced the French as the DRV's enemy number one in the Indochina War. The time, he said, had come to change their strategy from that of an armed line of protracted resistance to one of peaceful negotiations. In short, the Vietnamese had to win by peaceful means that which they could not win on the battlefield in the short term. On the 17th of July, 1954, the Vietnamese Politburo officially changed its policy from an armed to a peaceful strategy and agreed to sign the resulting armistice on the 21st of July. The Geneva negotiations did not produce a peace accord, but simply an armistice and a declaration, a pledge by those signing it to organize elections to unite Vietnam once and for all under a sovereign state, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, now based in Hanoi, or as the Associated State of Vietnam operating from Saigon. That in mid-1954 the Americans and the new Prime Minister of the State of Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, then refused to sign the declaration boded ill for the prospects of peace in Indochina. And the Geneva negotiations provided no concrete ways for requiring either of the two Vietnams or their respective backers to comply with the declaration. The DRV hoped to win by the ballot box in the future what its army had been unable to win on the battlefield, whereas the ASV sought to get rid of the French colonialists in order to build up a viable nationalist alternative to the communists with the backing of the United States. The Geneva negotiations might have achieved a ceasefire, but the declaration it produced could do little to stop the Vietnamese from going to war against each other. Nor could they stop the Americans from transforming their indirect war in Indochina into a direct one. Chapter 10. A Tale of Two Republics. In July 1963, Nguyen Thuong Tham received a summons to report to a nearby military police station to answer questions about his role in a failed coup attempt against the Southern Republic's president, Ngo Dinh Diem. Tam was one of Vietnam's best-known anti-communist politicians and a cultural giant from the 1930s, better known by his nom de plume, Nhat Linh. He had led a cultural revolution based on the liberation of the individual and the renovation of Vietnamese society. In the 1940s, he had helped to revive and lead the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, the VNQDD, which was opposed to both French colonialism and Vietnamese communism. While Tam had briefly worked with Diem to build a non-communist Vietnam during the Indochina conflict, he now despised the man for what he and his family were doing to the country. Instead of unifying non-communists, Diem was attacking anyone who defied him, and in so doing, Tam was convinced, ensuring that the cherished republic would fail. Tam was not alone in his hostility to Diem. A Buddhist protest movement against the No family was gathering strength as well. Nguyen Thuong Tam had no intention of joining Diem's long list of non-communist victims. On the auspicious seventh day of the seventh month of 1963, he sat down with his sons in their home in Saigon to enjoy their customary family chat. It was to be their last one, for their father had mixed a lethal dose of barbiturates into his own drink, a glass of his favorite Johnny Walker Scotch whiskey. The champion of individual liberty had decided to take his life to make a political point. In words strangely reminiscent of Nguyen Van Thin's suicide note of November 1946, Tam wrote a similar message: "Let history be my judge. I refuse to accept any other judgment. The arrest and detention of nationalist opposition elements is a serious crime, and it will cause the country to be lost into the hands of the communists. I oppose these acts and sentence myself to death as a warning to those who would trample upon freedom of every kind." Radio services, newspapers, and friends beamed the message far and wide as thousands of people gathered to watch Tam's funeral cortege file by a few days later. Ngo Dinh Diem's security forces carefully monitored the procession as it paused for a prayer service at the Zha Loi Buddhist Pagoda before it moved on to Tam's final resting place. This temple had become the nerve center for Buddhist protests against Ngo rule. A month later, Ngo Dinh Diem's forces occupied the pagoda in a harsh clampdown on the opposition. As one officer fighting communists in the provinces expressed his anger at the Ngo family to an American friend, "I'm a Buddhist now." He was not, but his point was clear nevertheless. Things could have been different. Many nationalists who were opposed to Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963 had placed their faith in this man only a few years earlier. Not only had he pushed the French out, but he had also succeeded in getting the Americans to end their support of the French protectorate over the Associated State of Vietnam in favor of a fully decolonized, non-communist Vietnam. Many had been happy to see Diem end a century-old French policy of divide and rule in favor of the creation of a modern nation-state, organized top-down, capable of taking on Ho Chi Minh's communist state in the north. So what happened? The question divides Vietnamese and non-Vietnamese to this day. But before we try to answer, we need to return to the end of the First Indochina War to understand how the two authoritarian republics, one in the north, the other in the south, had come into being in the shadow of the Cold War. Resetting Non-Communist Vietnam, the Republic of Ngo Dinh Diem. The rise of the Ngo and the American break with France. The American decision to back the French against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in order to contain global communism had undermined the Associated State of Vietnam's independence bid. When Bao Dai's first prime minister, Nguyen Phan Long, tried to gain American support for a fully decolonized, non-communist Vietnam in 1950, it was easy for the French to replace him as the Americans looked the other way. Containing world communism trumped the promotion of decolonization. During a tour of Vietnam in late 1953, Vice President Richard Nixon cautioned Vietnamese nationalists not to push the French too hard as the showdown at Dien Bien Phu shaped up. And when King Norodom Sihanouk took his independence crusade to the United States that year, John Foster Dulles had infuriated the mercurial monarch by saying that now was not a good time. There were dissenting American voices, however. One was the Democrat senator from Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy. He personally visited Vietnam in 1951, meeting with a wide range of French and Vietnamese officials. Despite French reassurances that all was fine, Kennedy left with the distinct impression that France was in no rush to relinquish its colonial hold, and that by supporting the French instead of the Vietnamese, American policymakers were undermining their own Cold War strategy. Fellow Democratic Senator Mike Mansfield also visited Vietnam that year and came away with a similar feeling. From their positions on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, they called on the White House to put pressure on the French to accord Vietnam complete independence. In July 1953, Kennedy joined Republican Senator Barry Goldwater in trying to get the Eisenhower administration to persuade the French to decolonize in exchange for continued U.S. military aid. French grants of limited independence to the people of Vietnam, Kennedy pointed out, have always been too little and too late. The Republican majority defeated Kennedy and Goldwater's amendments, fearful that such pressure could lead the French to pull out of the war. Léon Pignon's strategy of containing American pressure to decolonize was working to perfection. That is, until Ngo Dinh Diem, the man the French had sent packing a few years earlier for demanding dominion status, decided to make the non-communist case directly to the Americans. While Diem had no master plan to present to Washington upon leaving in 1950, he and his brothers wanted to shift U.S. support from the French to non-communist Vietnamese nationalists. Ngo Dinh Thuc, his brother and one of the country's first Vietnamese bishops, put his international Catholic connections at his brother's disposal. This gave Diem the use of several monasteries from which he lobbied both sides of the Atlantic until 1954. In meetings with a wide range of American diplomats, clergy, statesmen, academics, and journalists, Diem began making his case. As McCarthyism shook the American political establishment, he repeated to his listeners that the French failure to decolonize was only helping the communists, while also pointing out that the French colonial powers were playing the Americans for fools. Despite difficult encounters which repeated the well-known mantra not to push the French on independence right then, Diem slowly built up a network of support extending well beyond that of the Catholics alone. By early 1954, his contacts included some of the most influential Americans of the time, Senators Kennedy and Mansfield, statesman Dean Acheson, Supreme Court Judge William O. Douglas, renowned intelligence specialist of wartime Eurasia, William Donovan, and the influential Cardinal Francis Spellman. Diem also had an active interest in economic development and built up a lasting relationship with specialists in development theory. This networking put him in the right place as more American officials began to question the strategic wisdom of supporting the French. Mansfield came away from a lunch with Diem in May 1953 with the feeling that if anyone could hold South Vietnam, it was somebody like Ngo Dinh Diem. Inside Vietnam, others in the Diem clan, especially his brother Ngo Dinh Nhu, promoted the nationalist cause among disgruntled Vietnamese politicians, youth groups, Catholics, union leaders, and their workers. A labor activist himself, Nhu was the prime mover in the creation of a new nationalist political party, the Can Lao Nan Vi Cac Mang, or the Personalist Revolutionary Labor Party, often known as the Personalist Party. Drawing on the ideas of French philosopher Emmanuel Mounier, collectively known as Personalism, and influenced by leftward shifts in French Catholicism in favor of social action and anti-colonialism, Nhu imported Personalism to Vietnam. Particularly appealing was Mounier's rejection of liberal capitalism's overemphasis on individualism at the expense of building up communal ties and shared prosperity. Just as important was personalism's opposition to communism's abnegation of the human spirit and its embrace of an Orwellian party state. For the No Brothers, communism and capitalism were ideological dead ends when it came to rethinking Vietnam. Personalism provided an appealing middle-of-the-road approach to socioeconomic development, was respectful of human beings, and capable of empowering Vietnam's large peasant population, but without unleashing a destructive class war, as did the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the North and Maoism in China. Personalism, mixed with a lot of nationalism, would put Vietnam on the right post-colonial track, and, the No's felt, appeal to Catholics and non-Catholics alike. The No Brothers' strategy of positioning themselves and their cause close to the Americans and disaffected Vietnamese paid off when both international and Indochinese situations changed rapidly in 1953-4. Firstly, inside Vietnam, Bao Dai's passivity left many convinced that they had to take the nationalist cause into their own hands or pass for collaborators with the French. Secondly, this frustration manifested itself in an increasingly ardent desire to create real political parties, a national assembly, indeed a republic, so that nationalists could mobilize party politics and use these institutions of democracy against Bao Dai, his ministers, and their colonial backers. Thirdly, the French government's unilateral decision to devalue the piastre in May 1953 in order to boost metropolitan exports outraged all. It was humiliating proof of just how subservient the relationship with France remained, but it also served as a rallying cry for angry nationalists. When the new French government, led by Joseph Laniel, promised to complete par faire, the Associated State of Vietnam's independence, the No Brothers were determined to make it happen, even if it meant bringing down the French Union. However, the rapidly changing international situation in 1953-4 also posed threats, much the same ones that the Democratic Republic of Vietnam confronted. Stalin's death in March 1953, a rapid Sino-Soviet shift toward peaceful coexistence which culminated in the Korean War's ceasefire, increasing international talk about negotiating the end of the Indochina conflict, and Laniel's declaration to negotiate an honorable exit from Indochina. The main threat for non-communist nationalists in all this was that as long as the French failed to accord the Associated State of Vietnam full independence, there is nothing to stop the French legally from negotiating directly with the communist bloc, including the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and signing an international agreement over the heads of the ASV's leaders and people. As international exchanges on ending the Korean and Indochina conflagrations began in September 1953, the No Brothers went on the offensive against the French, Bao Dai, and his ministers. In September, relying on his wide range of contacts, Ngo Dinh Nhu presided over something called the Congress of National Union and Peace. This meeting gathered leaders from all of the major socio-religious and political groups who shared a general disappointment with the present government and its failure to secure complete independence from the French. This meeting intentionally excluded Bao Dai and his cabinet ministers in a move designed to underscore their nationalist illegitimacy, and caught the French off guard. Once at the Congress, delegates vented their frustration with Bao Dai and his associates, while others called on Laniel to negotiate full independence immediately. The message was clear. If Bao Dai would not lead, others would. More than anything else, this Congress allowed the No Brothers to promote themselves as the architects of an authentic nationalist alternative to failed collaboration. Within a few months, Nhu had created the Personalist Party and used it and his union contacts to build up loyal support for his brother as the only untainted third force leader who could stand up to the French unify non-communist nationalists, and convince the Americans to change their policy straight away. The September Congress spurred Bao Dai to action. In October, the head of the Associated State held his own meeting, during which he and his allies issued resolutions demanding full independence. The French dragged their feet, as always, in response, promising to negotiate, but countering that constitutional complexities and internal politics prevented them from moving faster. What the French truly feared was that by according complete independence to the Associated State of Vietnam in 1953-4, they would bring down their entire empire through the domino effect of that action. Indeed, as Diem and Sihanouk were making their cases for independence abroad, the French were engaged in a trans-imperial legal battle against them, as well as nationalists in Tunisia, Morocco, Madagascar, and Algeria making similar demands. Even as the French leaders watched Dien Bien Phu fall to the communists, they could not bring themselves to free the ASV from its imperial association for fear of what might happen elsewhere in their union if they did. As preparations for the Geneva Conference began in 1954, both Bao Dai and Ngo Dinh Diem left for Europe determined to force the French hand once and for all. This meant convincing American diplomats to change their policy of supporting Paris or risk losing all of Vietnam to the communist bloc. In early June 1954, as Zhao Enlai did everything he could to reach a deal with Pierre Mendès France, Bao Dai asked Ngo Dinh Diem to serve as his new prime minister. During the meeting between the two men in Paris, Bao Dai led Diem into a room where a crucifix hung from the wall. Standing before the cross, he told Diem, "Here's your God. You will swear before him to maintain the territory that we confide to you. You will defend it against the communists and, if necessary, against the French." Diem swore to it. The French, their Vietnamese allies, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had every reason to interpret Bao Dai's choice of Ngo Dinh Diem as a hostile action. More than anything else, Bao Dai's decision was designed to shift American support toward the Vietnamese in order to ensure that the ASV survived international negotiations. The Expeditionary Corps had not only lost the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in May 1954, but the French command was pulling back its troops. In early July, a communist regiment moving through the southern central highlands annihilated a retreating French airborne group near the town of Plicou. The Americans realized that there was no guarantee that the French army would stay, and the question of Vietnam's partition or temporary separation was already on the table in Geneva. Moreover, the debacles of the lost battles at Dien Bien Phu and Plicou only reinforced a growing stereotype in official American minds, which portrayed the French in Indochina in 1954, as it did Europe in 1940, as a second-rate world power. Mendès France only added to the frustration by failing to secure ratification of the treaty that would have created a European army. To many Americans, the French seemed unreliable in both Europe and Asia. It was in this complex and rapidly changing context that Dulles, backed by Eisenhower, began resetting American policy on Vietnam in ways already championed by Kennedy and Goldwater. In April 1954, the Secretary of State issued instructions stressing the extreme importance of getting the French to sign a treaty according full independence to the Associated State of Vietnam before negotiations on Indochina began. If the French could not do it, then the Americans would have to take an active part in the conflict, but only if they could collaborate with an authentic Vietnamese nationalist government. This was precisely what Diem seemed to offer, and this is why the needs of the Eisenhower administration and those of the Ngo brothers finally converged at Geneva in mid-1954, and not before. As the French signed the ceasefire documents and a declaration to hold elections in 2 years with their Democratic Republic of Vietnam counterparts, backed by Moscow and Beijing, Prime Minister Diem's government refused to do so and was fully supported by Washington. Separation, peoples, and choices. Neither the Nos nor the Americans knew where their new relationship would take them as the ink dried on the ceasefire agreement signed at the Geneva Conference. What we do know is that all parties present in Geneva at the time, including the United States and the Associated State of Vietnam, accepted that the French War for Indochina was over. The three states that had coexisted, intermingled, and competed with each other across all of Vietnam prior to July 1954 now consolidated into two parallel and separate states, the DRV sovereign North Vietnam and a still less than entirely independent ASV South Vietnam. Although the Geneva Agreements never sanctioned the permanent creation of two states, indeed, the declaration called for elections to unify the country into one state, checkpoints appeared along the 17th parallel, with each side's national flags waving in the wind on either side of what was becoming a de facto border. Before this happened, however, the Geneva Agreements required each state's military personnel and administrators to withdraw from their adversary zone and accorded civilians the right to move freely from one zone to the other until May 1955, 300 days. As a result, from late July 1954 onward, tens of thousands of French Union and Associated State Vietnam troops, civil servants, and their families began evacuating areas above the 17th parallel, while the Democratic Republic of Vietnam relocated around 100,000 military personnel and administrators from Lower Vietnam and Cambodia to the north. In all, around 800,000 people departed for the south, while 120,000 DRV personnel moved north. By May 1955, almost a million individuals in all had moved, thanks to French, American, and a first, Communist bloc transport. Never had so many people emigrated so fast at one time in Vietnam's history. As in Korea, Germany, and China, the impact of partition on the lives of these people was profound. Within days of learning of the results of the Geneva Conference's agreements, individuals began making hard decisions. Thousands of makeshift markets popped up across the country as civilians and soldiers, merchants and peasants, young and old, Viet and non-Viet, tried to sell things they could not take with them or buy materials they would need on arrival. Real estate prices plummeted in the north and skyrocketed in the south as administrators scrambled to find housing and jobs for the hundreds of thousands of arrivals. Landowners in the north sold what land they had and abandoned any hope of recovering that which the war had already taken and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had redistributed. Most of the 45,000 Chinese and several thousand French residing above the 17th parallel relocated to the south, to Asian port cities, to France, or to elsewhere in the empire. Many of the Chinese in Vietnam held Republic of China passports and moved on to Taiwan. Non-Viet soldiers who had fought with the French moved to the south, including 20,000 Hmong people. At least 500,000 Catholics left the north and in so doing shifted the center of gravity of Vietnamese Catholicism firmly in the direction of the south. 200,000 Buddhists also went south, including their main leaders. Heart-wrenching and tearful family conversations, separations, and inner transformations occurred everywhere as people made decisions in circumstances that were almost always beyond their control. Families left loved ones behind, never to see them again. Some were too old to travel, preferring to live out the rest of their lives in their native villages. Others stayed, determined to protect their homes, land, or livestock, gambling that the promised elections in 1956 would return everything to normal. Those moving southward with the Associated State of Vietnam implored relatives in the countryside to leave the Democratic Republic of Vietnam zone before it was too late, while those allied with the DRV pleaded with their kin not to leave now that the colonialists were finally going. A bright future was on the horizon, they said. Such arguments did not always convince those who had already experienced or feared the radical communization the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had implemented since 1950. Thousands of Vietnamese left communist zones, traumatized by violent land reform and the rectification campaigns discussed in the previous chapter. But it could work the other way, too. One cocky young anti-communist nationalist on his way out of Hanoi in 1954 was dumbfounded when a beggar boy took his money and thanked him with a word of caution, "The Viet Minh will come here before long. We poor people will be given property. You dirty rich people will be felled, and you'll beg us for money." But things were never so clear-cut in practice. Regardless of class or race, choices were complicated and loyalties blurred. Ever since losing her husband to the famine of 1945 and her only son to suicide, U Minh had worked as a maid for the family of the northern historian Duong Van Mai Elliot. Part of U Minh wanted to stay put in Hanoi out of her pride in the DRV's heroic victory over the French, but another part of her wanted to leave and go south with the only family she knew, the Duongs. In the end, she left. But even within the Duong family, like so many others struck by civil strife, loyalties were divided. While we in Hanoi thought our world was crumbling around us, Duong Van Mai Elliot later wrote of her sister, Thang and her Viet Minh colleagues exploded in celebration at the news of the victory of Dien Bien Phu. Thang had dedicated her best years to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam struggle and couldn't wait to begin a new post-war life building a new Vietnam. Meanwhile, their father, Duong Tu Chu, oversaw the withdrawal of the ASV from the north. In April 1955, he left the northern city of Haiphong on one of the last boats out before the communists were to take over, not knowing what his Vietnam would become. Like his own grandfather, discussed in Chapter 3, he had dedicated his life to public service, and he had made choices in doing so. Now those choices would take him and his family far from their northern homeland. And then there was Jean Moreau, the son of a pencil-pushing French customs official and a Vietnamese-Italian mother. He grew up speaking Vietnamese, fascinated by the language, culture, and history of the people. In mid-1945, as Vietnamese nationalism surged around him and almost killed him, he joined the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and worked in military intelligence. French officers who encountered him at the 17th parallel could not believe that he could choose the other side. He did, and lives there to this day, a Vietnamese citizen. The United States, Ngo Dinh Diem, and the making of another Vietnam. Just as rapid changes in power relations transformed the lives of ordinary people in all walks of life, wars and their endings also reshape alliances on high. The Americans, French, and No brothers emerged from Geneva in a very different relationship from the one they had had going in. With Ho Chi Minh's state now set to take over all of North Vietnam from the capital of Hanoi, the Americans were now focused on supporting a fully decolonized, anti-communist, economically vibrant, and heavily armed South Vietnam, capable of holding the Indochinese line in the struggle to contain communism. While Eisenhower came remarkably close to going to war over Indochina in 1954, in the end, he resisted and turned to building up South Vietnam and spinning a collective security treaty around it, Laos, and Cambodia. No sooner had the president stated his domino theory in April 1954, that if one country falls to communism in Asia, they all do, than he set Dulles to work creating what became the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, SEATO, in September. It was in turn part of a wider web of American treaties, which ran from the Atlantic Alliance in the west to bilateral ones in the east with Japan and Taiwan, linked from below by a southern chain going through Iraq, Pakistan, Bangkok, Australia, New Zealand, and the Philippines. The Southeast Asia Treaty Organization connected up this Eurasian rim of containment for the Eisenhower administration. It also served to block the Chinese from using neutralist-minded, non-communist states like India, Burma, and Indonesia to break this chain. And given that Zhou Enlai sought to neutralize Indochina against the Americans, Washington extended SEATO's protection to the Associated States without formally admitting them to it. Rightly or wrongly, American strategists were convinced that the Sino-Soviet Treaty signed by Stalin and Mao in 1950 had not only consolidated communist domination of Eurasia, but that it now would allow Moscow and Beijing to push into the whole of Southeast Asia via Tonkin, as the Japanese had done in 1940. As we saw in Chapter 1, the Americans and the Japanese were by no means the first to recognize Vietnam's strategic importance as a gateway to Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean. While Ngo Dinh Diem shared American anti-communism, he focused first and foremost on securing a fully decolonized, economically modern, politically centralized, and legitimate nation-state. He and his family were convinced that only they could do this, given, in their view, that so many nationalists had become compromised since 1947 by gambling on the French or sitting on the fence, they saw themselves as the chosen ones. Their successful actions in 1953-4 seemed only to confirm it. Critics, however, saw a dangerous turn toward authoritarian rule and nepotism, as Diem leaned ever more heavily on his family. But what counted most, the Nos retorted, was action and results. Time was short. The colonialists and the communists had just bargained away half the country at Geneva. In over his head, Bao Dai kept Diem on as prime minister and gave him precisely what the Ngo family wanted, full powers. Communists lined up behind Ho Chi Minh remained as convinced as ever that they were the rightful masters of all of Vietnam. Neither Bao Dai nor Ngo Dinh Diem had taken up arms against the French. Vietnamese communists easily portrayed the head of state as a puppet, and they rightly pointed out that for all of his tough talk, Diem had sat on the fence for years while the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's leaders and people had made huge sacrifices. The Greater Vietnam Coalition, the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, and Nguyen Thuong Tham had relied on French military power rather than create their own armies to fight both the French colonialists and the Vietnamese communists. Had it not been for French and American military support, Vietnamese communists would be in charge of all of Vietnam. Instead, the DRV had fought the American-backed French and Associated State of Vietnam to a draw. In agreement with his allies in Beijing and Moscow, Ho Chi Minh had convinced his party that the Democratic Republic of Vietnam could win via the ballot box and unify what was theirs through political means in what appeared to be a period of détente in mid-1954. But the communists also knew they had gambled and perhaps had done so badly, for neither Ngo Dinh Diem nor the Americans had signed any legally binding agreement enforcing them to organize elections in mid-1956. And it remained to be seen if the French would remain as the executor of the agreement, or would they change course along with the Americans. This is why the Geneva Conference of 1954 may have marked the end of French fighting, but it was potentially only a pause in two separate, though interconnected, wars, a Vietnamese and an American one. As long as both Vietnams were content to focus on consolidating their states, one in the north, the other now rebuilding the south, then the ceasefire of 1954 could have held and could have easily produced two separate Vietnamese nation-states today, as in the case of the two Koreas and Chinas. However, if one of the two Vietnams decided that it would renew its claim to sovereignty over or within the other's zone, then the Vietnamese Civil War would resume as one continuous conflict, with its origins in the civil violence of 1945-7. The French War might have ended in July 1954, but that did not mean that the one among Vietnamese had. Similarly, the conference at Geneva can be viewed as a pause in the indirect war for Indochina Washington had operated since 1950. For if the French had manipulated American anti-communism in order to hold on colonially in Indochina, the Americans had also used the French army, colonial administration, and their Vietnamese allies to help fight their global anti-communist war along Eurasia's southeastern flank. The Americans had paid for 80% of the costs of the First Indochina War by 1954, precisely because it was their war too. Given the high cost of assuring Western European security, not to mention the Marshall Plan, their direct participation in the Korean War, and their maintenance of a global web of military bases, this indirect strategy using the French army and administration in Indochina made good economic sense. America's global containment operated precisely through such direct and indirect forms of action. The French communists were not the only ones to point out that France was exporting soldiers to Indochina in exchange for dollars. No torch was necessarily passed in late July 1954 from the French to the Americans. No sparks flew from the embers of one empire to light the flames of another. Two empires, three if we count the Japanese one involved during the Second World War, had already intertwined in complex and fascinating ways for decades. Contrary to what is often claimed, the Americans were not newcomers to Asia or Indochina in 1954. Their black ships had opened Japan in the 1850s. They had colonized the Philippines in 1898, at the same time as the French had consolidated their hold over Indochina and the British had taken over Burma. President Franklin Roosevelt had closely followed Japanese colonial expansion down the Chinese coastline from 1937 onward into Vietnam in 1940-41, and then, from there, deep into Southeast Asia. During the First Indochina War, the Americans operated indirectly through such institutions as the Military Assistance Advisory Group and the creation of French commando operations in the highlands, while the Chinese communists did something remarkably similar in supporting communist Vietnam in order to keep the Americans off their southern flank. If anything, Washington sought to replace the colonialist French-associated state of Vietnam with a fully decolonized state of Vietnam. And as long as the Americans did not tread on this new Vietnamese nation-state sovereignty, just as they had previously carefully respected French colonial sovereignty in Indochina, and Vietnamese nationalist leaders did not endanger the U.S.'s strategic investment in Vietnam by negotiating with the communists, then a new alliance could work in Indochina, which would allow the Americans to contain Eurasian communism indirectly and continue to expand the informal empire they had been building across the Pacific Ocean since the 19th century. Such a global perspective, taking into account Vietnam's position on Eurasia's eastern facade where so many empires collide, helps to explain why this country remained so important to the Americans right through 1954 and arguably to this day. And if one takes the time to consider how China may have viewed the American presence, it's not surprising that Beijing was deeply interested and what happened in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. But the ASV was not yet fully sovereign. With the Democratic Republic of Vietnam serious about reaching a political solution by 1956, the Nos understood that they had a 2-year breathing space in which to transform the Associated State of Vietnam into an independent nation-state. With the full powers now granted to him by Bao Dai, the Prime Minister issued decrees which would place the selection of independent-minded regional and provincial authorities in his hands. Village councils lost their centuries-old autonomy to Ngo Dinh Diem's desire to impose top-down rule, though it never worked out so neatly in practice. He also wanted control over the armed forces in order to free it from the French, and use it to subdue those Vietnamese opposed to his nation-building. On the 11th of September 1954, he relieved General Nguyen Van Hinh of his command of the ASV's armed forces. Furious, Hinh immediately began plotting to overthrow his rival, confident that the French would back him. Despite often seething French hostility toward Diem, Nguyen Van Hinh badly overestimated his French partner's ability or desire to help in post-Geneva Vietnam. Hinh also underestimated the No brothers, who were turning younger, frustrated nationalist officers in the army against him, carefully casting Hinh as a creature of the French. The No's required officers and civil servants to join the personalist party and study its ideology. Once again, Bao Dai backed his prime minister. Hinh lost his army and moved to France. Despite strong misgivings about Ngo Dinh Diem, the first American ambassador to the Associated State of Vietnam, General Lawton Collins, and the last French High Commissioner for Indochina, General Paul Elie, reached an accord in December 1954, through which the Americans joined the French in training the Vietnamese army from January 1955 onward, while the French would start withdrawing their forces from the ASV and relinquish control of its armed forces by July of that year. In exchange, the Americans would continue to provide military assistance and training via the Military Assistance Advisory Group they had created in 1950. While the overarching goal was to ensure the outfitting and training of a Vietnamese army capable of taking over from the French, the Collins-Elie agreement dovetailed nicely with Diem's determination to push the French out and take control of the army with American support. Indeed, this accord allowed massive amounts of American military aid to flow directly to the Associated State of Vietnam instead of via the French, effectively ending Pinon's protectorate and America's proxy war enacted through the French. Emboldened by such direct support and confident that he could win more of it, on the 28th of December 1954, Ngo Dinh Diem requested the French to withdraw all of their troops from the ASV. In May 1955, as required by the Geneva Conference's agreed date for a ceasefire, the French withdrew from northern Vietnam, which was now being turned into DRV Vietnam. In 1956, the Expeditionary Corps left the south, removing one of the most dangerous threats to Diem's rise to power and ending a century of French colonial domination. With Bao Dai's full backing, Ngo Dinh Diem threw himself into creating a truly independent nation-state in record time. On the 20th of July 1954, he formally withdrew the Associated State of Vietnam, ASV, from the French Union, thereby finally making it the State of Vietnam, SV. He destroyed Indochinese federalism alongside his Lao and Cambodian counterparts when they all agreed to abolish the Indochinese Office for Currency Affairs, the Office Indochinoise de Change, in December 1954, and with it the colonial piastre. Each state officially printed its own national money and administered separate customs, immigration, and border patrol offices. National borders now separated Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. In February 1955, the French Ministry of Relations in charge of the Associated States disappeared. Having freed Vietnam from colonial federalism, Diem promulgated strict nationality laws turning ethnic minorities into Vietnamese citizens, required the Chinese, over a half million, to adopt Vietnamese nationality or leave, and denied French nationals most of the legal privileges they had enjoyed since the 19th century. Like his communist competitors, he nationalized education, imposed Vietnamese as the national language, and dispatched diplomats across the globe. However, Ngo Dinh Diem's nationalist partners of 1953 to 1954